Hey everyone, Brian from All Day Rock Off here, and today's podcast episode is with Chris Way, where we talk about GoRuck Ascent. GoRuck Ascent was the first non-challenge type event that GoRuck put on. It has a huge history with the company. They ran them every year for a number of years. I don't see one on the calendar for 2020 at this time. And so I thought it'd be fun to get someone on to talk about the history of the event, how the event evolved, and kind of what it led into. I really hope you enjoy this episode where we talk about GoRuck Ascent. You're listening to the All Day Rock Off podcast, episode number 140. Thank you so much for downloading this episode. Before we get into it, I wanted to give a brief explanation from GoRuck's website on what Ascent is, in case you haven't heard of it. GoRuck Ascent is a three-day mountainous navigation adventure where there were survival classes taught by GoRuck cadre and wilderness experts. Chris Way taught a number of courses throughout a number of years at GoRuck Ascent, which is why I thought it'd be fun to have him on for this. At these courses, you learned land nav, survival training, climbing, mountaineering, wilderness medicine, and for most of the ascent events, you also climbed at least one 14,000-foot mountain. I hope you enjoyed this episode. It's a fun piece of history. Here is the interview with Chris Way. So before we get into, you know, some of the stories from the ascent events, I mean, Ascent's not on GoRuck's website anymore, so it might be worth talking about, you know, what exactly GoRuck Ascent was or is, kind of the length of the event, what it was billed as, and what the goal of it was.
At the time GoRuck Ascent was created, I was a GRT, but I wasn't a cadre. So how it actually fell out at a round table or something like that, I don't know. I could speculate. But in 2011, I did class 051. And then 056. At 056, I met essentially the first cadre. His name was Brian. Other than the founder, Brian was he had been on the A team that Jason was in for a little bit. And Brian, having spent a lot of time at 10th group and then in 19th group, was connected to the mountains. He lived in the mountains here in Colorado. And my understanding was that they wanted to create a type of event that was then called capstone events, where alumni of the challenge, which was the only event, you know, they proved themselves by earning a patch and then they could start doing things. And so the first one that rolled out was Ascent. And if I remember right, there was a certain amount of community service or donations that people had to raise. And then there was an entry fee. And then you'd go up into the mountains. And I know that Brian was passionate about, he was passionate about the lineage of the special forces and where they borrowed, learned from, and continued to train in that kind of spectrum of heritage. And he was interested in the SAS. He was interested in Native American tribes. He was interested in all sorts of things that gave that community, you know, various skill sets to function in different environments. But the mountain environment, having come from 10th group, I think he wanted to really share some of those mountain experiences. And being here in Colorado, there's plenty of mountains to be able to hike up. And Colorado has quite a few 14,000-foot peaks. So the idea was, you know, have all these alumni from around the country come out here for a weekend and climb a 14er. And I think for the most part, that's what the goal was. Everybody come out, we'll hang out for a couple of days and we'll hike a 14er. And so in 2011, they had one. I had spoken with Brian and, you know, we kind of developed a friendship and we talked about skill sets and training. I brought ropes and kind of brushed up mountain skills at his house prior to the event. So I was there, I didn't go on the hikes with him. And we kind of refreshed Swiss seats, rappel, notes, different types of knots, and then kind of refreshed environmental considerations, because kind of a stickler for the weather here. We got a lot of mountains, but that can sometimes be tempting to get up and get yourself, in terms of 14,000 foot peaks in North America, Colorado's are the easiest and the safest, but you can still get caught off guard with some weather. So I went there as kind of as an assist, an advisor, and then the event took off. So I don't have a ton of memories other than coming up there, cutting rope, cutting tubular nylon, setting up anchors around his house, and then kind of casting everybody off for their hikes. My understanding was that after everybody kind of sat around and did the, you know, war story kind of stuff, they went up into the mountains, they camped for the night, woke up early, and then really, really early, and then hiked up some 14ers, and everything went well. And that was kind of how it started.
And I'm glad you brought up that initial part as well, because I'd totally forgotten about the fundraiser efforts. And this kind of segues a little bit off to the side, but I think that's kind of how, you know, the whole GoRock Sky Mall thing started, was because to do these capstone events, first you had to have already completed a GoRock challenge, which is now called the Tough, but it was the only event GoRock ran at the time. But in addition, you had to raise a fairly substantial amount of money. I want to say it was somewhere between $500 and $1,000 for the Green Bray Foundation. I think the event was fairly cheap. It was like $199 or something, or maybe it was $299. But I remember thinking the event was cheap, but you had to raise a ton of money. And then that's kind of where the patch market came from, because people were making these patches and selling them as fundraisers for the GBF so that they could go to these capstone events.
I remember the time, but it's kind of hazy. I do remember in the spring of 2012, I had been spent a lot of time with Brian, and I had come up with a concept for an event that I had called Dunes, and it was essentially, I guess now, what ended up being turned into a Navigator / Heavy / Ascent. So maybe it was like the No-Goa with an Ascent component. But anyway, I came up with the concept, put together a huge document, and then made a patch for donations for the GBF. And some of them are still floating around there. They're kind of tan and brown dunes, and they say come hell or high water. And so the hell or high water patches are around. I remember Fergus from Seattle, he had one, and you know, a bunch of the old Francev, and you know, I mean, plenty of people got them because we earned enough to get the event kind of rolling. But then that custom event never got to the point of getting to the ground. But that was spring of 2012, and I think that was for fundraising purposes, to get that kind of multi-environment challenge concept thing launched, which was then kind of used to build Navigator, No-Goa, and Ascent, and even some Constellation stuff. But you're right, that was back then when patches were made for GBF donations. And that was the first one that I made in the spring of 2012. And we kept that template for the event, but it got broken up into different parts. And I don't know what happened to the donation part. I think that maintained itself for a couple of years.
Yeah, I remember you had to do donations for Beached. You had to do donations for Trek. I can't remember, you know, when that kind of fell off, but I remember for a couple of years that was a big component.
I can't remember. I participated in Trek 05. And I mean, we had done so much fundraising with the Ruck Across America and this Dunes thing that I'm not sure if that was rolled in or what. But anyway, after that, I stayed connected to Brian. Brian brought in a teammate, a current teammate of his, who turned out to be Kedra Joel, and they were in the 19th group together. Joel had come from 10th group, but he was on a dive team. Then I did a number of events with Joel. I had an injury before I started GoRuck, had some surgeries, but then I ended up having to get bolts put in my neck, and that was the spring also. So then I completed selection class 01 in December of 2012, I want to say 8 months after I had the bolts put in, and that was with Lou. And then Lou, Brian, Dan, Joel, and a bunch of other guys were involved with the next ascent, which was also at the same spot the first one was, but then I continued to offer rope kind of back end support before the event started. And but I kind of stayed away from the hiking component because at the time I just didn't work for GoRuck. And so being able to assist was fine because it was something that, you know, I had done for a living and that I've done for 30 years. They wanted subject matter experts kind of advising the plan prior.
That makes a lot of sense.
I think that, you know, Brian and a lot of the other guys, they realized that, you know, any skills that were obtained about anything came from a source that, and that usually wasn't internal, that, you know, it was sourced externally. And, because I had done that before GoRuck, it took a little while for them to kind of find out those links and make those connections. But then they realized that it's a role that I had done. So it was kind of a natural rollover. I'm not a huge fan of hiking, believe it or not. So I didn't want to participate in the hikes up the 14ers, but, you know, I was happy, more than happy to help out, do refreshers and make sure people had the skills, offer my advice in terms of what I thought was good or bad. And sometimes that, you know, went over well and sometimes it didn't. But I think that was a good thing about the group of guys that ended up the next few years coming together is that, you know, whether or not people agreed with the decisions, they were willing to hear them out and then weigh the pros and cons and make a plan that was formulated based on informed decisions, which is kind of cool.
So that first year of Ascent, I mean, that was the first capstone event that GoRuck had ever put on. I'm pretty sure that was the first non-GoRuck challenge event that they'd ever put on. So I know you didn't, you know, go on the hike for it, but you were around, you assisted with the ropes. I'm curious, you know, what people thought of that event, if you had, you know, heard from people as they came back from it, if you were, you know, up there with them, because if I recall it all, it was, you know, it was a little interesting.
Yeah, again, like, you know, I didn't go out, so I don't have an opinion based on somebody that went through the entire event. I was there before it started, and then I was there at the pig roast afterwards. It's much different than it evolved into. You know, I think some people were happy. The community of people attracted to GoRuck at the time were a lot different than now. And so, you know, they were certainly as a group, as a whole, you know, much more capable of just kind of getting kicked in the nuts and smiling about it. And, you know, percentage wise, at least, you know, that's my opinion. And so I think they came out expecting, you know, a camping trip and hiking up a 14er, but people don't know what that's like. And so I think that any kind of the overall reception was generally good. I think, you know, they got less food than they wanted. My understanding is that, you know, some people liked it. Some people were kind of neutral, and the neutral people was largely just because they didn't know what to expect and they came out and got what they got. And back in those days, a lot of the events, you know, they were just kind of a rough sketch of certain criteria. And in between, you know, it was kind of like, let's create our own adventure. And sometimes that fell short just because there wasn't a sequential series of steps and benchmarks that you need to accomplish to get to the end. So they're like, all right, well, let's go hike a 14er. And they did that. So now let's go back and drink beer. And things are slow in the mountains. And I think that was something that people realized over the 7 or 8 years that it happened, is that the pace is a lot different than a challenge in the city. You can't just go up and haul ass into elevation or into any kind of environment that's non-urban and rush and do things that you could in the safety of the city. But the event didn't get canceled. And I guess that's the you know, the real thing. I think after the first 2 years, they realized they needed a change. And that's when Joel came in as the director and really implemented a curriculum. But it took till the third ascent for the curriculum to get laid out. And that was based on mountain team training that they had in 10th group. And there were also folks from first group that were on mountain teams that advised on that. And at that point, Ascent changed from old school GoRuck events, you know, and you could say that, you know, Trek was like that, you know, maybe not the last one or two, but you know, the first 5 or 6 treks, the first 2 navigators, the first 2 ascents. You know, the only event that broke all of that was the first heavy was so well planned. I think that really set a standard for all events in terms of structure. But before, you know, that stuff, everything was the Wild West.
I mean, no one really knew what to expect for anything. And
yeah, well, they're throwing out ideas and saying, yeah, man, let's just, we'll just do it. And then I think the mentality of, you know, they're good at learning and doing whatever got kind of taken a little bit out of context to like, yeah, we'll just run whatever kind of event we want and we'll see what happens. And then people outside of a challenge context being given a little bit more liberties to throw in their imagination led to some pretty out of control events, and that had to change. And that's probably why Trek disappeared and some of the other things that happened. But that's not really a conversation I want to have, because I participated in them and had a good time. But I understand, not being a business person myself, but I can understand that that's not a business model that's going to be successful. So what happened, I mean, in terms of the history of the event, I think there were a few phases that kind of transitioned through GoRuck. And right around ascent number two, let's see, I did selection December 2012, and then heavy was in January, maybe it was February. It was still the winter. And then I met a new guy, came in, his name was Bert. And I met Bert summer of 2013 in Boulder at selection, the selection that Tim Irwin passed. And I hung out and I talked with Bert and Bert and Lou about events, because Bert was trying to kind of push into helping develop and run more events. You know, and he was good at coming up with a lot of ideas. Actually, Brian was deployed with Dan, and so Bert had kind of this open canvas with some of the people that were involved in those events out of the picture for a little bit. So that's when NOGOA came into play. Bert came back out here to climb with me and train with me and kind of do his due diligence on my skills. We went to California. We scoped out Tahoe. We scoped out Whitney. Then I went with Joel back to California. Then we had a big Navigator event, because those got restructured too. And that was kind of like a big meeting of the minds with new cadre that were really psyched on coming up with events that actually had standards and skills that were applicable. And, you know, my personal philosophy was that skills were way more important than just holding somebody's hand and walking them through an experience. And to me, the 14,000 foot requirement seemed silly, but because that's how it started, that was maintained for a long time. But being able to come in and say, you know, we have to have a safety component. I think there should be physiology components so people understand what's going on in their bodies, environmental considerations. I think we should have a well laid out plan and then bringing people that actually have knowledge and experience, not just people that satisfy special operations. Because as you know, that doesn't mean much of anything. So we needed to find people that actually had skills in the curriculum that was being taught at the event, and then some experience with that. And so having done that for 30 years almost, on expedition level planning, training, and traveling around, I was able to advise and assist, saying, you know, these are the criteria that I think are important. And we kind of picked who was going to be at those events and how they were going to be run. And that kind of happened there at the end of 2013, beginning of 2014, which was pretty cool. We were doing scouting. We were laying out curricula and really setting standards and guidelines for, you know, you're going to come to these events and you're going to learn specific skill sets that then you could take on your own adventures and apply them in the field. And we're going to do that in a way that, you know, people aren't going to be as likely to get hurt, you know, because my personal opinion was that it was just a matter of time doing the events that the way they were until somebody got hurt, which would end the events altogether. And it wasn't really doing much for people. You know, once you pass that threshold of an event or the challenge at the time, it seemed like it would be cool to then offer training courses where you got to learn specific skill sets. And when, in terms of ascent, there are a lot of really useful mountain skills that could be applicable in everyday life. So let's think about it and look at it that way. And it took a while to get people that were on the same page together, but that happened. And I think that was a big turning point for ascent in a positive way. Some really cool things happened at that point forward that couldn't have happened, you know,
So the event kind of turned from a weekend getaway into the mountains. Let's climb a 14er or two into something that had an actual focus around skill sets and still included at least one 14er.
Yeah, for sure. And although I was always trying to get the 14er component taken out, because, you know, unfortunately for an event of that duration, and you have people coming with all sorts of different backgrounds from different places in the country, getting them up a 14er in a short window of time wasn't possible for everyone. And so you did have a big spectrum of people that started to show symptoms of altitude, started to show symptoms of food or ill preparation. And the group had to be separated. And we did a really good job, or the best job that we could, at identifying different groups of people based on their physiological response to some tests that we did at the beginning. You know, saying we're going to climb a 14er set everyone's expectations to I'm going to get to the top of a 14er. But in 3 days, you know, it's irresponsible to say I can get anybody to the top of a 14er. You know, I mean, it's just like saying I'm going to take you bow hunting and in the next 2 days we're going to find an elk and, you know, get it. That's just not going to happen. And nobody ever could say that they could do that. You know, it doesn't matter. And that's why the curriculum for Ascent had to be changed to involving safety, physiology, environment, planning, and then take that knowledge and experience and apply it. Because no matter what, every group that you take out that doesn't do it regularly is going to have a couple folks that fall out. You know, and people that spend their lives in the mountains or in the wilderness or in any kind of austere environment, they understand that you can't just take random Yahoo XYZ and have them perfectly functional in those environments in that short period of time. So I was like, gosh, you know, we can do some really technical climbing. We can't guarantee that we can get everybody to 14,000 feet. And that was lifted right at the very last ascent. But that was something that I had always felt really adamant about. And we got tons of folks at the tops of 14ers. But I think one of the big gripes were, you know, I came out and I did this and I expected to get to the top of a 14er and I didn't. And 100% of those instances, you know, I want to say I made the call that person couldn't continue forward. And if anybody was going to get in trouble, blame it on me. But I wasn't willing to risk their safety and health, and then sometimes the other people's safety.
Altitude sickness almost doesn't care. I mean, I'm out, I live at 400 foot elevation. I'm in, you know, fairly okay shape, but, you know, who knows what's going to happen when you get to 12,000, 13,000, especially if you don't fly in early, you don't acclimate. I mean, there's so many factors. And then, you know, altitude sickness is pretty brutal on yourself, but it's also tough on the team because everyone's got to take care of you and get you down and keep you safe. It's a big thing.
Yeah, I think publicly they say there's no way that you can prevent it and so on and so forth. But you definitely see statistically a decrease in occurrence if people have certain physiological traits as they're going. And also, like, using their brain is really important. And there were some things that we could do to lower the incidence and lower the effects. And, you know, that because you spend decades doing it, but you don't if Cadre X was, you know, on a vanilla team and they got one experience where, you know, somebody gave them Dymox and they hoofed it up a mountain and then they hooked back down, people were sick, but they still made it. Like, that's a lot different than being qualified to take a group of folks and watch over them. And so we were able to get guys that understood the things that were involved in getting up those mountains, but we still couldn't guarantee, and we still didn't get you know, I want to say like 60-70% made it up, 30-40% didn't. I don't know the exact numbers, but you know, as an example, like every year you hear about the mountain teams here in 10th group having incidents at elevation, and those guys, you know, I mean, I can't say that they're necessarily fit or whatever, but at least in the goer community, you can imagine that if somebody's on a mountain team that they're relatively fit. And you know, just a couple of years ago, well, I guess it was 2016 or something like that, a couple of teams went up Long's Peak and they got sick and then they had to get rescued and it took a couple of days. And you're talking about guys that foot the bill for not having incidents, and they have incidents here and turns into huge fiascos. And that particular incident made the news, which they try to avoid. But I think that just goes to show that no matter how trained you are and how prepared you are, things can happen. You can't guarantee that people are going to make it up. And how you deal with it matters. And so the people that came and couldn't make it up were still able to rock climb, rappel, get map and compass work, learn a bunch of knots, create fires camp, and do a lot of cool hikes that didn't get them up to 14,000 feet, but they still got to see really cool terrain. And so that experience, I think, improves for a lot of people. And some people came back multiple years. Some people didn't, but I think the large gripe that I was aware of was that, if the drop dead time to turn around, no matter where you were on the mountain, was 11 a.m. and you were, 300 meters from the summit, at 11 a.m. I was on the summit, and I would, walk down, and nobody could pass me. I would just tell them turn around, and a lot of times you'd get in arguments, and you'd say, look, as a participant in this event, we're making the call and you got to turn around. People get pissed. Yeah. But it was a safety issue. And, I would say that was the biggest gripe after those changes were made, was there's a pace we need to go to get to the summit before 11. And this is what we're going to do. And if it doesn't happen, we're just going to go down. And, those left and right limits with the elevation, bound us a little bit, but we were able to add to the curriculum. We found better locations to have rock climbing. We taught people how to lead climb. We taught people how to traditional climb, top rope and rappel, and do a lot of cool stuff at lower elevation. So I think overall it was pretty rewarding program.
Yeah, it's got to be tough, for the people who are just a couple hundred feet away.
Yeah, I don't think anybody was ever a couple hundred feet, but a few hundred meters, sometimes, that could still be an hour. Right, depending on how technical the route is. In 2014, I want to say, I took an advanced group of people that were fit. They passed the physiological test that we did the first day. There was only five of us, but I was able to take that group out. And we did a monstrous route. It was something like 26 miles. We went over like two 13,000 foot peaks, and then we went up like a 14 something. And it was relatively technical. It's definitely got to be, fourth class, which is steep, and you got to use your hands and feet, and you wouldn't want to fall. It was a pretty awesome thing, but we were able to separate people out in physiological groups. And when we did that, it was a little bit more rewarding for everybody, because we were able to pick the easier peaks for the people that needed and start them earlier. And the fitter folks, we were able to go up more technical routes and kind of give them what they were. I say fitter, but that's not entirely fair. It was a fitter based on the assessments that we did, not how many push-ups can you do? Realistic assessments, not, the bullshit ones.
The ones that matter in the mountain.
Right, exactly. And actually, in that group, two of those people later went on to become special operators. One of them in the Canadian and on a mountain rescue team. And then another one here. So it's kind of cool to see these people that you take these assessments and you say, like, I think, these people are capable of this more advanced route. And then later on, they go on to continue to prove their capabilities. And then the other guys that were in that group have gone on to do awesome things too. So, it's cool to be able to see that certain assessments that you would do to determine somebody's capabilities are reinforced later with the things that they do. That I was always proud of that, as a cadre that took the advanced groups out, saying, I picked these people, and then seeing those people advance after the event in other parts of their life or in more climbing stuff. A couple of them have become pretty good climbers. A couple of them have, continued to be successful in whatever their pursuits are. Yeah, it's kind of neat to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And I didn't even realize that.
That was before, Joel was the director. So there was a few years where I was a cadre of events for Navigators, Ascents, No-Goas, would help and assist on challenges and toughs that heavies that had off urban components. And so I was always able to select the groups that I thought were able to go with me. And I tended to be able, as a subject matter expert, be able to say, like, we're going to go, we'll divide up the terrain and let's push the capabilities. So everybody kind of got pushed. But if you already had skills, then you wouldn't be pushed by a group that was new. So you know, I felt very fortunate being able to take out people and really kind of push their actual skills. And yeah, I mean, huge, huge number of those people have gone on to do really cool things, you know, including at least one is a SEAL, you know, maybe half dozen special forces, Canadian special forces, two of them became MDs, a couple of them, you know, successful triathletes and climbers and, you know, number of other things. I mean, you know, quite a few have just continued. I mean, because it's a personality trait. And I think that's the opinion that I had, but also have continued to hold, is that it's not a title that somebody has. It's the personality they have accumulates accomplishments as they go. And some people really admire a title. But when you get to know those people, you realize it's not the title that they have. It's that it's a personality trait of doing what's necessary to be successful at whatever the task is now. And, you know, that program really introduced me to a ton of people that I still keep in touch with simply because they demonstrated those capabilities, and we were able to bond and share those experiences. And I love that about that program.
Yeah, and it seems like it, you know, really changed over the years, because like you were saying, those first couple of years, they tried to get everyone to the top. And then, you know, once it started transitioning over to more skill set base, you're separating out in groups, you're going out with an advanced group. Not everyone's getting to the top, but there's now skill sets they can learn while they're out there. So it's not like they're just sitting on their hands waiting for people to come back. It seems like to operate like that there must have been a decent number of cadre at some of those events. You know, how many people would usually show up for those?
We were in the 40s, probably something like that. Let's see, 2014, there was a Navigator. Navigator had been going, but it was kind of the Wild West style events. And then we had one in Tahoe that was actually a custom Navigator, and we had two back to back. We had a beta test to test the format, because at that point we were doing the curriculum breakdown, breaking people into capable groups. And we put together a huge group of awesome cadre. I'll name drop for a sec. You guys know Danny, the guy, he's riding his bike from Alaska to Chile.
Danny Stokes.
At this Navigator, it was pretty impressive. I rented out a ski lodge that was closed for the summer. And we went up there, and it was kind of like this crazy meeting of the minds. And so Danny was there, Chris Clark. That's where I met Danny Stokes, met Chris Clark, met Mocha Mike, met Tyler Gray. Bert was there, who I'd been doing stuff with for the year prior. Mike, what do they call him now? Handsome Mike. Joel was there. Dakota was there. Made a fuck ton of dudes, and we all just hung out and broke down the curriculum, really went over those skill sets. So we were able to break out medicine as like a completely separate class. We were able to break out survival as a completely separate class, rope skills, land navigation, benchmarks, and everybody was able to talk about their experience doing that, and the things that worked for them, things that didn't, the tests that they had to do, what worked, what didn't, what was excessive. That was a really good event, and that actually changed the Navigator events from that point forward. We were able to extract some of the classes we were doing in Ascent that weren't necessarily mountain realistic to more of a wilderness thing. It turned out that as an expedition climber and leader and a researcher, I did research for scientific projects, you know, in jungles and desert, all over 6 continents. And so my familiarity with that stuff, you know, kind of also allowed me to participate and add to the think tank that developed the skill sets required for an event like this. And so not just the Ascent exploding into like a course in itself, but also the Navigator program kind of exploded into a course in itself, which kind of made sense, right? If you think about the Q course as being a bunch of classes that provide people with skills, you know, I think a lot of people like the idea of GORUCK having this network of classes where people, you know, pass through some sort of a gate and then had coursework where they were able to obtain skill sets. And of course, there were some folks that either didn't have the skill sets or they just wanted to kick, you know, people's asses doing the challenge. And that's cool too, because you definitely need to continue to do that. You don't get complacent. That really changed the scope of all those types of events, I think, really overhauled at that point, and then continued to do kind of self-maintenance from that point forward. Of course, you know, Danny's gone, Chris is gone, Tyler's gone, Bert's gone, Joel's gone, Dakota's gone. So most of the minds that were involved in this process have moved on. But, you know, and I don't know, you know, for, you know, whatever reasons, but the idea that you want to give back to the community of people that are putting themselves out there and giving them skill sets was something that everybody, you know, that now is gone. It's something that they valued. And, eventually that kind of deteriorated, but, for, you know, 4 or 5 years, it was a robust system that really offered a ton of really cool skills. The mountain skills stayed relatively constant. We continued to add technical climbing. So everybody started off around 5.5, 5.6, got the skills required to be able to lead bolted 5.5s, 5.6s, people that showed competency in that were able to, you know, lead as hard as they could possibly lead. And if they had any interest in putting in traditional gear, and, you know, which is removable gear instead of clipping bolts, I taught them how to do that. And we continued to push that envelope. And some people since have continued and have, you know, double, tripled their climbing abilities. You know, people that had never climbed before were scared of heights, could barely claw their way up 5.5, are now leading, you know, 5.11 traditional routes, keeping in touch with me. And I think that's really cool. That really was, you know, one of the things that I would hope happened from the program, and quite a few people have done that and continue to do that, which is really cool. At least to me. And then after that, we decided to streamline people based on their skill sets. So in 2016, we decided to kind of have like a selection process for people that were going to run Navigator and Ascent. And so BD was working there by then, and BD got involved, and, you know, he's very good at being able to say, you know, instantly saw the safety risk and the requirement of having a certain standard and competency and skill sets. So what we did is allowed people to prove their skill sets and prove that they actually liked to do it and they knew what to do, not just, okay, you know, they got a, you know, 1 week class and XYZ and then haven't done it in 10 years, but actually prove that they know what they're doing and continue to be able to do it and can troubleshoot some of the questions that continued to arise the year prior at Navigators. And so we went down to Texas and we had, you know, a 10-day train up, and again, this giant meeting of the minds. And that's when Brett Vernon, Mickey Banks, Doug Wong, Brian Squared, Mocha, BD, Joel, all got together and reformulated some of the Navigator Ascent curriculum so that it was a little more efficient and there was a little bit less downtime. Because one of the things was that with the groups being separated, we'd have standard times for rappelling and rock climbing and medicine and weather. And but then there was downtime, because if a group went out and they took, you know, 8 hours, another group went out and they took 5 hours, what happened in the 3 hours in between? And so some of those people started to get antsy. So then the program was again overhauled so that there was less gaps between the different groups that went out. And that also worked really well. And that was applied to Ascents and the Navigators. And then Navigators got broken into different types because people wanted one-day Navigators. And that's kind of where things started to fall apart, you know, trying to change the marketability so that there was mass appeal. So instead of 30 people, they wanted 100 people. And they can't do it for 3 days. Let's do it for 1 day. Or let's do a 12-hour. But it just didn't seem realistic. And so it was really hard to get the minds together to say, here's a format where we're going to actually teach people skills, kick them out, test them safely, and assess them. In that kind of time frame, you lose quite a bit. And out of that came Constellation. And Constellation was project Chris and I started for, you know, an urban type navigator, and it kind of satisfied some of those criteria and requirements. But again, it started as a 5-day event, and it got hammered down. But that was kind of right around the time where people started to leave and everything kind of dismantled itself. So I guess I understand that Constellation is still around, but it's a hard thing to take skill sets and train people with different backgrounds and not have the time to do it and also be able to assess and not just do kind of corny, cheesy projects. And so, you know, the core group that I had, we were always pushing for longer events, you know, 3, 4, 5. We wanted 7-day events where we could really immerse people in environments and have time to digest those skill sets and see that a lot of this stuff isn't fast-paced. You know, survival is really slow-paced. Navigation is slow-paced. Going through actual jungle is slow-paced. And you can't do that unless you actually get into those environments. But the process just didn't lend itself to that. And as a result, you know, I ended up resigning, and basically everybody involved ended up resigning over the course of about 6 months. And since then, I haven't had a ton of visibility on GoRec stuff because I've been involved in new things.
And it's really interesting to watch that progression because, you know, like you were saying, it starts out just the mountain, and then it turns into the skill sets that are involved with the climb as well. And then it just keeps growing and breaking out. And, you know, then there's the navigator level of events. And then you can kind of, if you timeline it, you can see how everything started shrinking. Then they did the, you know, the shorter navigators, and they brought out the expeditions and the 6 hours that they got it down to at one point.
Yeah, and it was fun to be involved with, for sure. But, you know, a lot of those decisions were made from above about finances and marketability, and those are things that, you know, I'm not an MBA, I don't run businesses. So to me, those there was always some back and forth, like, why, you know, how are we going to do this? Well, I'll figure it out. Okay, well, I can't see how it's going to work. We'll do this. Well, that doesn't teach any skills. And, you know, there's some back and forth. And then it's like, well, I think, you know, right towards the end, it was like, well, then screw it. We'll find somebody that can do it, even if they don't have the criteria that you guys think. And then it was like, oh, fuck it. Then you don't need me. And you know, I don't want to badmouth that. I had a great lot of years, and the process kind of fell apart there as they were trying to run a successful business. And that, nobody's to blame. It's just very hard to produce something that satisfies all the criteria without, you know, my opinion is that, you know, you keep it fixed and have the fixed criteria, and the class doesn't change a whole lot, instead of constantly changing everything and breaking it down to shorter, easier to digest. And I don't know what the right answer is, but I definitely felt very strongly, and I think I still do. I absolutely think that, you know, you learn things by being immersed in it and repeating it and gaining the skill sets, the competency, and then testing it in increasingly challenging environments till you're able to do whatever your goal is. And that to me is a recipe that has made a lot of success in a lot of different disciplines, a lot of different environments. And so it's hard for me to see outside that box. But again, like, I'm 45 and I've been very, very actively pursuing that stuff since I was about 15 or 16, you know, to the point where as a late teenager, I did it professionally and continued to do it for different types of organizations. So it's hard for me to see outside that context of somebody that, you know, they're closing in on a 30-year career doing a lot of different adventurous stuff versus, you know, people that in those environments don't have the same type of experience. But I also don't have a successful business that, or, you know, whatever it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I guess now I'm mumbling. But it was awesome, you know. You know, some of those best years were from 2013 to 2018. I just, you know, in 2018. But, you know, the thing that, you know, it's a total tangent, but one of the more successful things, at least, I don't know how successful it is actually, but I get the impression that the firearms program is very successful. And that's exactly what we had earlier, which was a fixed curriculum that was giving people specific skills. Maybe not as sexy as guns, but those kinds of extracurricular instructional programs offer people skills that they can use in their real life. And to me, there's a lot of value in that. And I met Machine, let's see, he had been working for GoRec a little bit in 2014, but we actually did a Navigator together. He didn't come on board the Navigator team after that for the big event because he didn't feel he had the training and skill sets. And that's one thing that, you know, always made me appreciate Machine a lot was the ability and the other guys that I worked with that we kind of picked out is their ability to say, you know, I wasn't trained in that. I'm not current in that, you know, but I'm interested or that has, you know, that's not something that I ever did. I don't think I would be any help in being able to kind of self-select for the different types of classes that they had skill sets for rather than just saying, fuck yeah, man, I could do it all. And having nothing to back it up other than enthusiasm. The enthusiasm goes a long way, but it's pretty easy to see through whether there's substance there or not. And Machine and I, you know, at least I felt like we hit it off pretty well in North Carolina. We had a really good time. But he was able to say, you know, these are my skill sets and my skill sets don't really overlap with this. And then they came back to with Constellation. So it's funny how they kind of come and go. And, you know, I like him you know, a lot of our skill sets overlap. And so I think it, you know, he's somebody that I've stayed connected to and really respect and appreciate because he's able to say, yes, I'm comfortable talking about this or no, I'm not because I'm not current, you know, or being able to say like, yeah, I was training this, but it's been a while, so I'm not current. You know, why don't somebody who's more current talk about this skill and then let's have a refresher and refresh those skill sets. And, you know, that's something we did with the Navigator team regularly, but across the board, I thought it was something that needed to happen, but it's expensive. And, I think that's really important. You know, for me, some of the guys, like I always held an active EMT and wilderness components of that and maintaining that, you know, I hate titles and I hate credentials and I hate people that kind of wear that out front. But it was the idea of, you know, not so much like here's a title, here's a certificate, whatever, but, you know, do you understand how to do this in this situation? And do you understand how to do this in this situation? And if we're going to teach stuff, that has to be current with all of us. So can you go out and navigate on your own and get from point A to point B to point C accurately and quickly? You know, I get it like you've done it once, but let's keep that an active skill set. And if not, let's get back to proficiency or not do it. And so we're always maintaining proficiencies and emphasizing the proficiencies that we had at the moment. I think that's cool. And it also makes people feel good because you're working on different things and everybody had projects that they were working on and brushing up on and sharing with each other and cross training. That was a really exciting number of years. And, you know, it brought, you know, not only like great friendships, but also a lot of really cool memories and experiences that without a group of people willing to do that, you know, there'd be no other way to get those experiences, which were really fun, you know? And I feel like, you know, although I've never been involved with the firearms program, that's something that they're doing to make sure their skill sets are high. And that's why I feel like that would be, you know, a good program to be involved with.
It definitely seems like they have a good following with their firearms program. I mean, there's tons and tons of those events happening.
Yeah, but I think underneath it, it's the traits that the people have and the willingness to maintain proficiency and continually refresh skills and learn new skills and assess and question. I mean, I think, you know, underneath everything, that's the thing and then maintain those experiences, you know. And I'd look for that with anything. You know, if somebody went to, if I go to the doctor, you know, I get a physician or something like that. Like, yeah, I probably don't want to pick one that's straight out of med school, but if I had to, like, what do they do in their off time and what kind of skills they maintain? Are they doing various things? And that doesn't just mean that they've got a bunch of certificates on the wall. Cause to me, every year that happens, it becomes more and more meaningless. Like you can get a certificate in anything. So it's not the certificate, it's the attitude and the activities that people are actually doing, because getting a certificate is way too easy. Like, what have you done with it? What do you do? Because I would rather pick somebody that does something without a certificate over somebody with a certificate that just got it to give it. And those guys seem to be actively involved with maintaining various skill sets. And I like that, you know, just because of that attitude and that personality type.
You know, that makes a lot of sense. You see it even on the professional side, right? People who just go and collect certificates versus people who are using the skills that they've learned.
And it comes from a good place. So, you know, I don't want to go on a rant, but there's a big difference between me and people that do stuff and don't, you know. And so I don't care like what your Strava numbers are. If you can go out and kick my ass in a marathon, you're good running. You care about running. Like if I show up and I'm like, oh yeah, this jackass doesn't even have these badges. Like, so what? Right?
I mean, looking at Gorek selection this year, right? You know, Kalyniak showed up to selection and finished it, and he hasn't done any other Gorek events. You don't have any Gorek patches, but, you know, came out and finished selection.
Yeah. I mean, that's happened before, I think, but I think that I don't know him, but I've chatted with him on the selection group, and he seems like a great guy. You know, I think that most people that could show up and do something like that obviously care about the things that they do, and they have an attitude of success, and you know, it goes more into the mental stuff that I'm also a big fan of. But you know, there's a certain, I'm not saying like, you know, attitude of success is going to make them millionaires or whatever, but there's a certain type of person that can pick up objectives and go accomplish them. And so the idea of failure is not really something that's going to cross their mind. You know, if I said, hey, we're going to go run a 10K, you're not thinking like, oh my God, I wonder if I'm going to finish, right? So you're going to approach that with a presence of confidence, and you're going to approach that with a presence of, I'm obviously going to do this, but I'm going to do this and follow whatever your running goals are. And so you're going to do it. And then afterwards, people aren't going to be like, oh shit, that's so sweet. You finished a 10K. You're not concerned about finishing. You're concerned about, you know, how was my heart rate? How was my breathing? What was I thinking about? Did my, you know, stride feel good? Right. And then when it's over, now you're thinking about the next one. The next one and the next one, and along the way you may have produced something that somebody would go, oh fuck, that Brian Lohr, like he ran, you know, XYZ, but you're not thinking about that anymore, right? And I think that, you know, maybe not everybody, but most of the people that pass election have that kind of attitude of, you know, I'm gonna go do this, I'm gonna work hard, you know, as nervous as they might be or whatever, they've got an attitude of, I'm going to be successful at this. And then when it's over, they take a deep breath because they've got another goal. And I've said that before, but I think that is a common trait. Like, you're not looking for a title. You're not looking for a finish line. It's just a part of your process. And I think if they had attitudes or the other attitudes, you know, they would have started a selection finisher brand and start selling all sorts of shit, but they're not those types of people, right? They didn't go to selection to market the fact that they did selection. You know what I mean? And although, you know, you see more and more people trying to market their accomplishments, there are people that just are out there doing stuff. And there's an attitude where you would meet, I mean, I can think of, you know, quite a few people who, if they decided to go to selection, would pass it and move on, and they would like it and they would say it was hard and challenging, and they wouldn't belittle it, but it wouldn't be something that did anything but reinforce their identity and continue to move forward. And of course, you acknowledge that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, like there is an air of I don't want to say confidence, like, you know, your ego, but you understand, like, I've done stuff. This is how I do things, and I'm not gonna not do this because this is how I came to it. And so not knowing Alex or any of the guys that finished the last couple classes, and I don't really stay too attached to, I feel like I've talked to Alex a little bit because after selection, he decided to go do a sniper competition, and I've been competing at those for the last couple years. And so we chatted about that. And then a few of the guys are doing other types of goals that are along some of the things that I'm doing outdoors. And so I've talked to them, but we never ever, I want to say, Gorek has not been a word used in a sentence in any of our conversations. And I think that's telling about the types of people that pursue personal goals and personal excellence of whatever your priorities are. And I'm not talking about, I mean, they tend to be physical because I tend to go towards physical things, but it could be learning French. And if I was going to do that, I'd move to France and immerse myself in doing that. And it would be, that's how I would do it, right? Or I would involve myself somehow you know, 100% into that. And I think that that's telling of a guy like Alex, not knowing him and making a lot of assumptions, is that he's constantly ironing his character. And so it wouldn't surprise me if he did a lot of things that people posted about on Facebook, but it's telling that, you know, other people are more impressed than he is because he's just learning and moving forward. Right. It's kind of weird to talk about somebody I don't know in a way that, but that, that would be my, if I had to make personal judge of character, that that's where I would start with him. And I could be totally wrong, you know, I guess it's probably inappropriate, but that's how I would like him to be, I guess, projecting. Anyway, that there's a window into my projecting into other people for you, for the psychologists out there. Anyway, I think that people that want to accomplish stuff, they definitely need to learn those skills, and you got to go to the right place to learn them. And when you go to those right places and you learn those skills, hopefully it's with people who, that's their thing, right? And that's their thing, and they'll do it whether you're there or not, and they'll continue to do it whether you're there or not afterwards.
That's the goal.
Yeah. And any name that I brought up, you know, today in terms of cadre and participants or whatever, you know, that's my take. You know, I keep in touch with all of them, and all of them have continued to pursue kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, leveling up. Like, they're maintaining their skills and they're gaining new skills. And what else can you do? You know, I mean, if you're doing the same damn thing over and over again, holy cats, we're different types of humans.
Yeah, it's always important to be looking for the next thing, you know, looking at what your current goals are, but then also looking ahead at what your future goals are. And if your future goals are the exact same thing as your current goals, then maybe it's time to do some reassessing.
I definitely appreciate and respect people that have the one thing that they do, but it can't ever be the same, right? Because every time you do it, you're doing it a little bit different, hopefully a little bit better, or deepening your understanding, pushing forward so that you can use it in a way that, you know, helps you get to wherever you're going, whether that's, you know, perfecting the zen of the thing that you do, or offering more skill sets that open up life experiences. And, you know, for me and for the, what, you know, influence that I ever had on the Expeditions program, it's that I really enjoy going to places that people don't normally go to in the world, and being able to function or get through there safely, right? So most of my skill sets involve being able to go into places that are dangerous and get out alive, right? Whether that's the top of a mountain or across a glacier or up a waterfall or through a desert or a jungle or, you know, Mexico, you know, whatever that is, that tends to be a pursuit that I particularly enjoy and appreciate those skill sets, and they happen to overlap with that program. But, you know, if it's firearms, that's kind of machines, you know, especially sidearms and personal defense and security and protection kind of stuff. Like, that's right up his alley, and continues to train and learn about it. I think that's a cool thing, you know?
So since
going all the way back to, you know, the history of Ascent, you know, kind of, I kind of think back to like Lou and Brian, who were really interested in the history of their lineage and the mountain teams. And that's how Brian's continued to live too. He's that same personality type of learning skill sets that overlap with the lineages that trained his predecessors, that trained him. And he's always pulling in skills from those different environments, bringing them back to the mountains, back to the wilderness, back to kind of analog skills that can then be put into his pipeline to continue to do the stuff. And so he, you know, had explored opening up his own school, and, you know, I mean, obviously he does whatever stuff got him to Gurukh in the first place, but, you know, those lineages and bringing in the skills from outside to learn and then apply to the path that you're following is a really important skill set. And takes a little bit of mentorship, and it takes a little bit of understanding the path and understanding where you're going and how you want to do it, and what are quick ways to do it so that you don't get trapped into doing the same thing over and over again, right? You want to learn it to proficiency and then move forward instead of being trapped in a cycle of I'm not ever getting better, what's going on?
So since you brought it back, were you by any chance around for the event that led to the patch with the hot dogs?
Dan's hot dog? Yeah, I know Dan at Ascent here had ate some hot dogs and ended up having a patch made of that. They were out on the hike up in the Collegiate Peaks here. You know, I think the one story that I wished I was there for is apparently Dan, you know, at the summit just lights up a cigarette and smokes a cigarette at 14,000 feet. And that, you know, kind of matches other stories and personal experiences with Dan. But no, I wasn't there for that. But I heard about it. I was around then. I wasn't with them, I should say. And Lou, although I knew him, you know, online, I met him at Selection. And so we weren't, you know, obviously that wasn't the friendliest encounter. It wasn't not friendly, but he was at Selection 01, and so I met him in D.C. for that. But then afterwards, we started to do more and more stuff together outside of events. So, Lou's a good dude, and Dan's a good dude. And you know, Dan and Lou both exhibit those traits of learning and applying skills and growing and kind of having that forward mission. You know, if I was going to look for people, those are the traits that, you know, I think I would want to collect. Yeah, the hot dog patch, though, is, you know, pretty famous, especially back at a time where patches were pretty new in terms of, you know, cadre patches and event patches and stuff, with there only really being the challenge.
Yeah, there was just a handful of patches, and you could easily have, you know, gotten all of them. Were there any other stories from Ascent that, you know, that you were a part of that you want to share?
You know, I think for me, the one that really stands out is that kind of almost run that we had in 2014 with a small group of folks up over Crestone and Humboldt, and, you know, across the Needle and then up Crestone Peak, and it was icy and it was awesome. We lost radio communication, and so we were kind of just this isolated group that was, you know, functioning really well. And we had a tremendous day, you know, and we got back, and we're so psyched, you know. And of course, that's the kind of thing where you get back and everybody's talking about what they did, you know, and everybody in that group just kind of sat down like, whew, that was awesome. You know, and nobody asked, and, you know, it was just kind of quietly appreciated amongst the six of us, and we were psyched. I got a ton of really cool stories about all sorts of events. So I would probably talk for 10 hours about individuals that overcame their fears and gained skill sets and went out then to apply them and learn them and become exceptional at those things. I mean, there were so many times where people would come scared of heights and then they'd turn into rock climbers. People who couldn't swim coming to Navigator, and we always did a water test where they would build a flotation device and get out and swim down a river or across a lake. And you're talking about people that cannot swim, but proving to themselves that they can make a device that can keep them from drowning, and lighting fires and hunting and tracking and navigating. You know, so many people were scared of the dark and couldn't freaking navigate themselves, you know, to their mailbox. Getting lost, learned how to use a map and compass, and passed the final exam, which was going out on their own at night for, you know, multiple hours to hit checkpoints, coming back successful. It was a really good and rewarding program, and I hope that, you know, if people did them, they might be able to share their stories, but I'm not totally comfortable sharing a lot of stories just because, you know, it would have to be shared by the people other than me. I didn't get in trouble.
Chris, thank you so much again for, you know, taking all the time to chat with me to talk about the Gorak Ascent series, because it's just one of those events that, you know, was the first capstone that Gorak ran. It had an amazing arc from where it came from, what it kind of evolved into, the events that spiraled out of it. And then here we are sitting in 2020 and there isn't, you know, an ascent on the calendar. So I wanted to bring someone on who had been to a number of the events, who had kind of experienced it. So I really appreciate this. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, everything evolves, you know, so I'm sure that there's new, fun, and rewarding stuff going on. It's just I'm not kind of up to speed on the new fun stuff. But you know, if they bring in people with backgrounds that have skills and they want to teach those skills, I'm sure you're always going to have the cadre that want to take people out, give them skill sets that are kind of in line with the way they live. I mean, I know most of the guys I know now are gone, but Dan Skidmore is still there, and you know, he lives his life a certain way, and he teaches his events in a way that really aligns with his personal philosophies and leadership style, making sure people are healthy and maintaining their bodies. And he's got a tremendous list of skill sets that are top notch. You know, he's been trained in quite a few things and has a lot of direct experience in those. And I know for sure, you know, if somebody was going to take an event and they took an event with him, they'd be getting a top notch, well-rounded event full of skill sets, whether they knew it or not, that he feels would help their life in a positive way. You know, and so, you know, that can't help but happen. And I imagine whoever they're taking an event from hopefully integrates those things as they line up with the skill sets and what's, you know, kind of active in their life. Because that's kind of how it rolls.
Thank you so much for downloading the All Day Rock Off podcast. This has been episode number 140. If you want links to anything we talked about during the episode, you can hit up the show notes, alldayrockoff.com/140. I really hope that you enjoyed hearing about Ascent. I was around when Ascent first came out and no one knew what it was. Gork had never run that event before. I think that was back in 2012. And I realized now that there isn't one on the calendar. They might not be running one again in the future, that there'll be people coming in who have never heard of it. So I just thought it'd be interesting to kind of get someone in here and talk about the history of that event. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to help support the All Day Rock Off podcast, you can always leave reviews on either Apple Podcasts or on Facebook. Just search for All Day Rock Off. Other ways to support the podcast, you can always buy stuff at alldayrockoff.com/store. Lots of rucking related gear there for purchase. Recently had a huge restock, so that's pretty exciting. You can also support through Patreon, patreon.com/alldayrockoff, where you'll get a couple extra bonuses through that as well. Again, really hope you enjoyed this episode. Show notes, alldayrockoff.com/140. And I can't wait to talk to you again next week. As always, don't forget, attitude is everything. Keep yours positive and drink hard, rock harder.